University professors and intellectuals are often dismissed as elites, divorced from real life and disconnected from the problems of real people. Today's guest sees their role differently and argues, in fact, that intellectuals and universities are agents of global change. He's Michael Kennedy, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and colleague G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk to storytellers and scholars about the impact of narrative on American public life. This week, we're joined by Michael Kennedy, professor of sociology and international and public affairs at Brown University. Throughout a distinguished career, he has focused on East European social movements, national identifications, and systemic change, big ideas that have a lot of meaning for us today. His most recent book is Globalizing Knowledge, Intellectuals, Universities, and Publics in Transformation. Michael, welcome to Story in the Public Square.
Thank you very much for having me.
I want to begin with something really foundational, and it really goes to the heart and soul of the show. As a sociologist, what role do stories play in public life?
Huh. You know, there was a guy named C. Wright Mills who wrote a book called The Sociological Imagination, published in 1959, and he said in that the sociological imagination is about the articulation between biography and history. Huh. So he might even be a good patron saint for your show.
Seriously. Yeah.
But for sociologists, the stories we tell about ourselves to one another become the foundation for the ways in which we connect with one another, the ties that make us one or divided. But those stories are also ways to divide us and cause conflict. So story, narrative, is critical to the culture that enables us to connect or enables us to conflict.
Well, and so then I think that leads right into what are the major narratives, the major stories that are shaping public life in the United States in 2017?
So I think one of the reasons I've actually started teaching introductory sociology again for the first time in 20 years. And I do that in part because I feel like we need the sociological imagination today more than ever. And that's in part because the stories that we used to tell about ourselves and about one another are changing in a pretty dramatic way. They're changing above all because of the ways in which the consensus that once defined, one might say, a democratic modernity, that somehow we're all about liberty, equality, and fraternity, or I would rather say freedom, justice, and solidarity, that holy trinity, if you can say that, that holy trinity is being frayed. It was being frayed originally by the character of globalization that overwhelmed us since the early 90s. But even more today, you can see that the kind of globalization that's affecting us is making people feel justifiably that they're losing control over their lives. And so one of the things that we're seeing across the world, and of course President Trump is a great illustration of this, is that he's trying to create a narrative in which we feel like we have control again. But I'm worried about that narrative, because that narrative is dependent upon a kind of showmanship that is actually deceiving the public from the character of the challenges that are actually facing us. We can't, in the words of a fellow at Oxford named Yen Golden, he said, there's no way that we could ever build a wall high enough to keep out the risks that endanger us. And so the idea that we can solve problems with walls or bans or even withdrawals from trade agreements, those are all illusory solutions to complex problems that we face.
The fact that many people feel they're losing control, and I think that is completely true. What is it about the human mind or about the human condition that prompts many people to seek solutions to that loss of control somewhere else, as opposed to their own individual world, whether it's their family, their neighborhood, their workplace? Why do they look to, in the case of the election of Donald Trump, a leader? What do they see there? What about the human story causes people to look at the bigger picture, as opposed to what people who practice Zen, for example, would say is look inwardly first for control?
I wish I'd asked that question. That's a good one.
Thank you.
Well, I actually, you know, for a lot of the students with whom I work, they come in frequently with some anxiety about the world they're facing. And my first piece of advice is not to read sociology, but to read Thich Nhat Hanh and Making True Peace, because true peace begins within.
Wow, that's a great assignment.
However, one of the things that I'm also cautious about is to say that there's something about the human condition that leads us to find things without. Because I think there's something about the character of our times that make us seek this kind of solution. But I shouldn't say us. Make some people seek this solution.
Right.
Because I would describe myself as a comparative and historical sociologist. I worked on Eastern Europe, as Jim mentioned originally. And so in that circumstance, for instance, my first book was on the Solidarity Movement of 1980-81 in Poland. That movement was not about seeking solutions in others. That movement was seeking solutions in community writ large. And so I think the character of America today is about two radically different visions of how to find solutions to the loss of control. On the one hand, there is this faith in what I've called in other publications Ubermensch escapism, faith in the strong leader who will save us. And this I find frankly dangerous, because that strong leader is inevitably going to disappoint us. But we can also find faith and hope in the communities and the ties that bind us. How is it, frankly, that we can find solidarity with one another? How is it, frankly, that we can invest in one another to address the problems that confront all of us?
This is the contrast between our two last presidents, right? Barack Obama, a community organizer, and Donald Trump, who is positioning himself as sort of the former of your dichotomy there. But you mentioned in one of your first answers the narrative in which we feel like we have control again. The stories that I hear coming out of this administration are not about that we're in control, it's that we're out of control. And they're sort of a dystopian description of America, American carnage in the inaugural address, a vision of what America is today that is not the America I know. And so I guess the question I'm wondering is, what role is there for objective reporting in the sort of these stories or truthfulness in the stories that are being woven?
So I think the first thing that's really important to put on the table is this point about truthfulness, because there are many different kinds of truthfulness. There's the kind of truthfulness that comes with objective data, mm-hmm. that comes with the idea that we are using our reasoning. We are trying to be coherent and consistent. And all of these things Trump is not. But Trump is truthful to many people. Why? Because he speaks with a voice of authenticity that mirrors their own. His voice is not the voice of a professor. This is one of the reasons why President Obama alienated so many people, that he had this voice that was that calm law professor style. Trump speaks like many normal folks.
Yeah.
And so he evokes a kind of truthfulness that speaks to their own experience.
We're a nation of 235 million people, give or take a few.
310 million. Yeah.
I'm sorry, 310 million, yeah. give or take a few. Is there one story that could possibly ever be embraced by all of these people, all of us? A unifying story that everyone, 310, 320 million people, could buy into and accept? Or has the world become too complicated?
So you're turning me into even more of a sociologist than I thought I was.
Well, I think
Do you know why?
That's why we had you on here.
Because one of the things that I would say is that not whether there's one story that can unite all of us, but do some stories unite all of us more than others, right? Let's turn it into more of a continuous variable than a categorical one.
Yep.
And so when we say, make America great again, this is clearly not including all of America, because the times that are being evoked are the times of real racist exclusion. That slogan can't work for very many people outside white America. We have to be explicit about that. Instead, I would have proposed, if I were running, Kennedy, I should, I suppose. if I were running,
you've had success in the past.
If I were running, I would say, let's make America greater than it's ever been.
Yeah.
That story means that everyone can become part of that radiant future that is our destiny, rather than what is our legacy.
That's a progressive message as opposed to a conservative, conserving message in terms of looking back.
So this is part of what I think we need to move beyond. People can read what I write.
Yeah.
They'll recognize that I'm progressive.
Sure.
But there are actually really important parts of the conservative message that progressives embrace. For example, right? What has always defined conservatism? Tradition, yes, but also community.
Mm-hmm.
Progressives are the ones today who defend community against those who would think that money and power are more important than the neighborhoods that we need to make safe, secure. Right there, I sounded like Trump.
Yeah.
But that's part of the message. That's part of his appeal. Is that he is breaking down all of these ideological oppositions, and it's time for sociologists and citizens and others to think about the ways in which we are tied together now, the ways in which we are tied together tomorrow, but the ways in which we would like to be tied together in the future. Because imagining that future is critical to designing the present that enables it.
So how do you break through the chatter, the clatter, the cacophony of voices, of sounds, of internet, TV, cable news, radio talk show, with that message, which I think most reasonable people on whatever side of the political aisle would agree is a good message? How do you get that story through?
So, I've actually thought a lot about this because I used to work a little bit around the challenges of religious diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Religious diversity is different because we all appeal to our own supreme law within our religion. There's no constitution, there's no supreme authority that unites us in that. But what I think that example illuminates is that we don't begin by focusing on that which divides us. We begin and look for the things that unite us, and we build the conversation around those things. And this is one of the reasons why, for example, I've gone on Dan York's show, for example. This is a local Rhode Island talk show, and he's not known for being a progressive. But he and I have some remarkable conversations, in part because he's asking me questions that make me think. And I'm giving him answers that make him pause. And together we can create a different kind of discourse that enables us to get away from the political polarization, which is going to destroy this country. But we can't have a fake unification. Because that unification that people propose, you follow my rules, and then we'll be unified. That's no unification. Unification, solidarity is based on mutual respect, mutual trust, mutual investment, recognizing that my fate is dependent on your fate.
We've got to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island. You can tweet me at JM Lutis. Alongside me is my co-host, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. You can tweet him at G. Wayne Miller. We're produced each week by the talented professionals at Rhode Island PBS, and an audio version of this program can be heard four times each weekend on Sirius XM's Politics of the United States, the POTUS channel, 124. Our guest is Michael Kennedy, a professor of sociology and international and public policy at Brown University. He tweets at @prof_Kennedy. So you didn't think that you were going to be resitting for your sociology comprehensive exams in this interview, did you? We wanted to also tap your expertise as an international relations scholar and someone who's worked in that area between sociology and history. And a nation's stories are often better known as their history. You've spent a lot of time looking at Eastern Europe. What in 2017? What are the stories, or what is the story that matters most in Eastern Europe today?
So when I was at the University of Michigan, I used to teach the introductory survey course for Eastern Europe. And I was always trying to explain why people should be interested in Central and Eastern Europe, even if they didn't have ancestors that came from there. And I said, this is the place that shows us the range of possibilities for the human condition. It has seen genocide, ethnic cleansing, and the destruction of peoples. On the other hand, it is the place that has given us some of the most refined ways of thinking about democracy and freedom and artistic creativity, both in the visual arts and the musical arts and in literature. There's something extraordinary about this region. And so I want to begin with that point. It's worth learning about this region if we're interested in learning about the human condition. But the key narrative today is that this region is so accustomed, if I can put it bluntly, to being sold out, because it's in between superpowers, Russia on the one hand, Germany on the other hand, the West more broadly. If there's a single word that captures the meaning of that recurrent selling out, it's Yalta. When Churchill, when Stalin, when Roosevelt got together and decided to carve up Europe to create a subsequent peace. No doubt, the people of this region are wary of a President Trump who wonders whether NATO is obsolete. No doubt, they're even more concerned for someone like Putin, who has been able to violate the agreements of the post-Cold War era and to take over Crimea, to invade Ukraine, to easily threaten the Baltic nations. And of course, Poland, the country I know best, is one of the most anxious of all when it comes to this, given its own history of being partitioned in the 18th century, and then, of course, not regaining its state until after World War I.
I think there was a time when there was a reverence for history. And by a reverence for history, I mean when the citizens broadly, the masses, understood that history was important. They may not have the time or the expertise to study it at great length, but they knew enough about it and about important historical topics to reach some kind of understanding about their world and themselves today. And I'm pretty sure there was that time, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. That seems to have changed. There seem to be more people today that do not have a reverence for history.
Yes.
And beyond that, don't have an interest in even learning. Dismiss it as eggheads preaching to them, I don't want to know that, I don't want to go there. What's happened?
So several things are happening in this. And frankly, I have to say, there is reason for spending less time on history, I'm sorry, than on understanding the complexity of the world today. Because the world is so moving so quickly. There are so many kinds of challenges that are historically unprecedented. The ways in which social media work, you can find analogs in history, but it's nothing like that. So my question, and this is the kind of thing I teach about and work on, is how does a historical awareness shape the ways in which we're dealing with this incredibly rapid, incredibly uncertain, incredibly insecure world in which we live? Clearly, we can't extrapolate from the past into the future. But we can imagine that people have certain cultural schema, that people have certain narratives, stories, built into their childhood, built into their public culture, that enable them to look at the same thing and come to very different conclusions. So if we were to think, for example, about the meaning of the European Union, the Brits could say, once we were a great empire, once we ruled the world, and that was when we decided what would be. Why is it that the Central and East Europeans value the European Union like nothing else? Because in the last 25 years, they have had a better period for their own history, more peace, more prosperity than they've ever had. So clearly, they're looking at the same condition, but their history is shaping the interpretation variably.
Well, so even though we don't want to get stuck in history, we're sort of still being shaped by it in a
Absolutely.
Lot of ways. You've said that leaders are informed by their nation's history, so I'm curious, what history is informing or shaping Donald Trump and his presidency?
So many people have made a living trying to look around the world for people who are like Trump. And there are many actors who are saying, the world is too complex, we need more control, and you need a strong man in power, and I'm that. Mm-hmm. Putin does that. Orban does that in Hungary. Jarosław Kaczynski does that in Poland a little bit. And of course, Brexit is the epitome mm-hmm. of this kind of solution. But Trump is not just someone with authoritarian tendencies. He's also someone who is a celebrity. So American culture has been organized around celebrity for so long, it just that we didn't have quite the fusion mm-hmm. of celebrity and politics that Trump is. We have had a democracy that has been disproportionately influenced by those who are billionaires. That too is part of American history. But the thing which I think is distinctive about what Trump represents, and something that should not be overlooked, is that we have a powerful culture of know-nothingism in America. And he's picking up on that anti-intellectual streak in American culture. And I'm, you know, one of those who would like to say intellectuals' knowledge is not elitist. Mm-hmm. But I am saying that because so many universities, so many academics have not been publicly engaged, that we're retreating into the ivory tower, that this is one of the reasons why his anti-intellectualism can take off.
It's, you know, that so your book, Globalizing Knowledge, looks at the role that intellectuals in universities ought to be playing.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about the book and a little bit about sort of the insights that you bring from that scholarship to this kind of conversation.
So that book is a reflection of 15 years of experience in lots of different ways. You know, I led lots of international efforts at Brown University, but also at the University of Michigan, where I was previously. So I think about globalizing knowledge. How do we learn from different places in the world in order to make a better America and to make a better world simultaneously? So that's the globalizing part. But the other part was that the University of Michigan, in particular, was a public university. Mm-hmm. We existed for the public good. But one of the things that we were never clear about is what does that mean other than giving preference to state citizens to come into the university. One of the things that clearly evolved at University of Michigan, and I continue it in my own work, is that we have to think about how it is that we do our work not just for our peers, but for the publics that support us. How is it, we call that public sociology, we call that public humanities. At Brown University, we talk about it now as engaged scholarship. So on the one hand, we have to think about the ways in which academics can engage publics better. But we also have to lose the hubris that so many academics have, that we have lessons for others. One of the things that I find most appealing about teaching, not just my students, but also learning in communities, is that I am much more interested in learning from publics and students than I am in teaching them the latest in sociology. And I'm interested in learning from them because I frankly believe that in the collaboration that we enjoy, the fusion of our horizons, if I could say that, we are actually creating a better kind of knowledge, one that is even like tailored to the people who are asking the questions rather than imposed given what I already know.
So the question is it too late for that to happen? We had a guest on earlier this show, Tom Nichols. He wrote a book called The Death of Expertise. And what he writes about and what he finds is that there is entrenched, certainly with many people, as you were saying, an anti-intellectualism, anti-elitism. If you purport to be an expert or are an expert, many people automatically dismiss you as elitist, as out of touch, not listening, already know it. Is it too late to change that? Because that's a large segment of thinking in today's American public. He writes about it at right. length in The Death of Expertise.
And by no means is it too late to change it. If we don't change it, you know, the world will be gone. there are some kinds of expertise that are absolutely critical to bring into our policymaking and public sphere. We need that expertise on climate change. We need it. But we also need different kinds of expertise that are typically not vaunted within universities and within publics. One of the kinds of expertise that I admire in journalism is, how is it that we communicate more effectively with one another? How is it that we learn more effectively? Social media creates the possibility for this kind of mutual learning. In fact, I have this playful project called Selfie Sociology. Selfies are, you know, you just go to hashtag Prof Kennedy Selfie, actually.
And we will after the show.
Well, yeah, I would like to
do that. I will, absolutely. But, yeah. I'm writing it down.
Well, no, we'll do one. Okay. And so what's important about this is that so many people can see selfies as evidence of narcissism and evidence of antagonism to expertise. But we can flip it. What we have seen in the selfie is this, the democratization of portraiture. The technology allows everyone to become something of an artist in presenting themselves. And I have taken it, and my colleagues and I have taken it one step further. It's also a way for us to connect across the world in a different fashion.
In almost a universal language.
It's a universal language. Actually, there's a great project called Selfie City.
Wow. This is fascinating.
Moscow smiles less than anybody else. You'd probably be amused to that.
Interesting.
But not surprised.
But it is also a way for us to connect across the world. I've taught this in Kosovo and in Singapore and all these places, and now they're all connected because they're all hashtag Prof Kennedy selfied.
We're just really almost out of time, so I've got to ask you one quick question. The president and some of his chief advisors have been talking about nationalism, right, and a return to American nationalism. In about 20 seconds, what does that mean? What is nationalism, and what does that mean for the American public?
Nationalism is really simple. It just means that every nation should have its own state. That means nationalism is everywhere across the world. So nationalism by itself is not the question. It's what kind of nationalism you have. Is it an open and inclusive nationalism, or is it a racist and exclusive nationalism? That's the question we should be posing tonight.
Unfortunately, Michael, we've got to leave it there, but thank you for being with us. Tremendous conversation. If you want to know more about Story in the Public Square or even watch previous episodes, please visit us online at pellcenter.org, or you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Until next time, for G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. Thank you for joining us.